Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at WBEZ.org/events.
Welcome to Worldview from WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonald. It was a dramatic day in Venezuela yesterday. We're going to talk about what changed and what didn't with David Smildy from the Washington office on Latin America. He's a senior fellow there, and he's a professor of sociology at Tulane University. Thanks for joining us again to talk about Venezuela, David Smildy.
Thank you for calling, Jerome.
You know, I wanted to take a step back from yesterday and kind of recall where we were at before yesterday. We were already at a place where there was another self-declared president, where there was no recognition of the Maduro government. There were a lot of things that yesterday was just like the day before.
Yeah. I think there's been a pretty big overestimation of what yesterday meant, you know, because already all of these countries did not recognize Nicolas Maduro as the president of Venezuela. And what changed is that they now recognize Juan Guaido as interim president, but Guaido still doesn't really have any power. I mean, I think it has implications for diplomatic relations. Basically, this means that Guaido can name ambassadors to these countries, and Guaido can receive these countries' ambassadors himself. And so it has that implication. But beyond that, it's not really clear. I mean, there is one big elephant in the room, and that is that, you know, Venezuela has a lot of assets abroad. In the United States, it has Citgo. It has refineries on the Gulf Coast. It has, it has loans that and debts as well. And so there's a whole set of assets and debts that Venezuela has in the United States and abroad that presumably would go to the hands of Guaido if these countries recognize Guaido as a legitimate president. Well, then he would be able to control those assets. But what that actually means, no, I think that was going to have to filter through courts for a while. And even if these assets were to be credited to Guaido and the National Assembly, they don't have a central bank. They don't really have institutions through which they can distribute this money. So it's not like they can really form a viable parallel government.
Well, yesterday's actions, it seems like a gigantic effort to up the pressure, and it certainly ups the danger for a lot of people. I mean, if I were working in the U.S. Embassy in Venezuela, I don't know if I'd feel particularly safe right now. I don't know if I was Juan Guaido, I would feel particularly safe right now. I assume if you're Maduro, you would want to arrest this person. What are the implications of what happened?
Yeah, I mean, it does. That is the most significant change, is that it really ups the pressure on Maduro, ups the stakes for the opposition, and for a lot of countries around the world. So, I mean, they're playing their most powerful cards here, and it's not clear where this is going to go. Guaido himself, as far as I can tell, nobody really knows where he is right now. He's tweeting, he's making statements and whatnot, but I don't see that he's in a public place. No, yesterday Nicolas Maduro said he was breaking all diplomatic and political relations with the United States. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo responded that Maduro is not recognized as president and can't do that. They only respond to Guaido, and Guaido said he's maintaining relations with the United States. And so apparently the embassy employees are staying put. I suspect that they will bring home all non-essential employees, but the idea is that they're going to keep the charge d'affaires there in the U.S. embassy in Venezuela. I don't think that Maduro is going to act against them, because you know the U.S. has been very clear in its threats that if Maduro tries to do that, that they will respond accordingly, or they will respond, you know, in kind. And so I don't think Maduro wants to mess with that. But, you know, apart from that sort of little micro spat, it's not clear beyond that what's really going to happen that's important here.
What is the logic of all this from the U.S. side? There's a lot of conversation about what this means in Florida, and Marco Rubio apparently has been driving and endorsing a policy like this for some time. Did these guys just get what they want, and what is it they want?
you know, there's two sides to this. Obviously, Marco Rubio has, as you said, been driving a lot of this policy. Florida, of course, is the most important of all the swing states, and Trump won it last time. And I think, you know, they're going to do anything they can to try and appeal to different constituencies in Florida. And Trump also has a bunch of other really complicated issues on his hands, including the Russian investigation. And so having some sort of foreign policy win looking powerful and decisive, I think, is quite attractive for this administration. On the other hand, you know, a lot of this is actually being driven by what's going on the ground in Venezuela. No, Maduro was elected in an election that was fraudulent, and back in May, that very few countries recognized. And he was sworn in for his second term last week on the 10th of January. And so that was kind of a breaking point, because a lot of the countries said, well, okay, well, Maduro was president. They didn't recognize that election, but he's not the legitimate president, you know, in this new term. And so that sort of brought it to a crisis. And the opposition also, who has this new leader, this new president of the National Assembly, who was recently sworn in, a person who's young, that is a new face and has some pretty good rhetorical skills, you know, challenging Maduro. And so the confluence of this, of Maduro assuming power in a second term that's not recognized by the international community, Juan Guaido assuming the National Assembly presidency, has sort of come to a head. And Guaido is saying that the constitutional articles that are relevant to the current situation make him acting president.
I'm talking with David Smildy. He's a professor at Tulane University and a senior fellow at the Washington Office on Latin America. And we're talking about Venezuela and what happened yesterday in Venezuela and the crisis there. It seems like the idea of Marco Rubio and the Trump administration is to bring pressure on the military in Venezuela to break with Maduro. And there's a lot of conversation about that and whispers that there are people in the military who don't like what's happening now and want to see something different. Is that a legitimate aspiration to break the military and break him away from Maduro?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's you know, a logical way to think about this, and I think, you know, that's what was the gamble yesterday. That, and I think it was very clear that the opposition, the U.S. and the other countries had coordinated that Guaido would swear himself in as president, and that he would immediately be recognized by all these other countries. And I think the hope was that having this president recognized by everybody in the region would get the military to say, okay, we have a new commander in chief. And in fact, after he did that, there was a several hour period in which the military said nothing, the Minister of Defense. In fact, when Maduro went to the balcony of the presidential palace and gave his speech, a very defiant speech about U.S. imperialism, the Minister of Defense was not with him, nor was any of the high command of the military. But after that speech, they did indeed come out. First, they tweeted with some support. It was not exactly effusive, but it was support for Maduro. And today there are videos of them, you know, with much, much more enthusiastic, broader support for Maduro. And so I think, you know, I think it was a reasonable idea. And I think, in fact, there was some discussion within the military about whether they were going to support Maduro, because, as I said, it was not immediate. But I think in the end, Maduro got past that hump. And I think, you know, it's not clear what happened there. But I do think that in the past 2 days, U.S.'s position, while I think recognizing Guaido was a reasonable thing to do, you know, all the chest beating around it, you know, the Mike Pence released a video saying he supported the Venezuelan people. It was a video that made a big splash in Venezuela, released that on Wednesday. Yesterday, Marco Rubio made statements. Trump made statements. Pompeo made statements. The National Security Council made statements as well. I mean, all this chest beating around this basically made this into an issue between Venezuela and the United States. And that's the ground that Maduro is much more comfortable on. No, I think when he has a big demonstration, a massive demonstrations yesterday, you know, against his presidency, and in this case, they were cross-class. There were many people from the popular sectors, in other words, the lower working classes that were participating in these. Maduro is not comfortable. I mean, I think that's much harder for him to deal with. But when he can frame this as a battle between the United States in Venezuela, well, then that's much more comfortable terrain. And I think that could have had an influence in the military sticking with him.
And if you hadn't heard a clip from our vice president, here it is.
Nicolas Maduro is a dictator with no legitimate claim to power. He's never won the presidency in a free and fair election. And he's maintained his grip of power by imprisoning anyone who dares to oppose him. The United States joins with all freedom-loving nations in recognizing the National Assembly as the last vestige of democracy in your country, for it's the only body elected by you, the people. As such, the United States supports the courageous decision by Juan Guaido, the president of your National Assembly, to assert that body's constitutional powers, declare Maduro a usurper, and call for the establishment of a transitional government. As you make your voices heard tomorrow, on behalf of the American people, we say to all the good people of Venezuela, estamos con ustedes. We are with you. We stand with you. And we will stay with you until democracy is restored and you reclaim your birthright of libertad.
When you hear the vice president talking like he did yesterday, it brings to mind what the Venezuelan people really want now. Do they want the United States to force this person in a coordinated effort with other countries from office, or do they want something different? I imagine, you know, there's a lot of talk about what the poor now want in Venezuela, and the poor is almost everybody. If you've got 80% of the homes that don't have enough food, you've got a lot of people who are going to be disgruntled and against the administration. Do they appreciate what Mike Pence has to say?
Well, you know, I think if you listen to Pence's statement, I don't think it was an unreasonable statement. I just think the timing of it and sort of the visibility of it was not what was necessary at the moment. I think the symbolism of it made it into an issue between Venezuela and the United States. I think the Venezuelan people, 80% of the country rejects this government. Over 70% don't want Maduro to finish his term. And I think people are desperate and really want a change, you know? And I think they're not. There's not big, strong concern about external imposition per se. I think people just want relief. But what that imposition looks like, or what that involvement looks like, I think is important. I published a piece a couple weeks ago with data showing that even if a military intervention got rid of Maduro, the majority of Venezuelans would oppose it. No, the majority of Venezuelans would support, however, some sort of negotiated settlement that would lead Maduro to leave power. No, so I think Venezuelans, what they want a return to democracy. They want a government that they actually vote into power. No, but they want that to happen through some sort of political settlement. I don't think that they're necessarily opposed to foreign countries being involved in that kind of negotiation. I think they would welcome that, but I think it's quite clear that a clear majority would oppose any kind of military intervention.
Is the problem, though, that there's been attempts to have those negotiated settlements of this situation every other year, it seems like, and they've all fallen apart? I think the Vatican went at it once.
Yeah, that is exactly the problem. And I think there's a real skepticism, I think, with good reason for that kind of negotiation. In fact, if you ask a survey question whether you think there should be dialogue, it's incredible. A majority of respondents, a majority of Venezuelans, say there shouldn't be dialogue. No, because they associate dialogue with two sides getting together and talking and discussing their positions and not leading to anything. If you say, should there be a negotiated settlement leading to Maduro's exit, then a majority of people support that. No, but of course you can't get there without dialogue. But the point is that people, you know, they don't want to see people sitting around and discussing it. They don't want to hear anymore from Maduro or from, you know, about what's going on. They want some sort of solution to this, and they prefer that it's a negotiated solution.
I want to ask a question about the countries that support Maduro, particularly the powerful ones like Russia and China and Turkey. If they want to see this guy stay in power, do they have to up their game? And it's not like Russia hasn't been upping its game. It's given a lot of loans. It's put some warships out there. Do they have more stuff that can keep this guy in power?
Well, I'm not a Russian expert, but I do think that it's interesting that China has been largely silent in recent weeks on this, whereas Russia has been speaking up a couple times a week. No, Russia seems to be much more supportive than China is. But the thing is, Russia just doesn't have the resources and the money to really support Venezuela. They've done what they can. China seems to be a little tired of supporting Venezuela. You know, it's put $60 billion of loans into Venezuela, and they've seen a lot of it get squandered. And so I think they're a little tired of throwing money into Venezuela, and they've also received quite a bit of criticism for it. Turkey is sort of the new person on the block that's a big ally with Venezuela, and they're putting together food cooperation. All these governments have in common that they're, to one degree or another, authoritarian, and they see, you know, themselves as allies, and allies that they can support and say, well, we support non-intervention, in part because it helps them with their own local populations, especially Putin. If he can support these other countries and be non-intervention, that supports him in his statements against people trying to intervene in Russia. So it certainly makes sense. And, this is foreign policy. We in the United States know about this very well. The United States supports dictatorships, supports Saudi Arabia when it's in national interest. And so I think it's logical that Russia, China, Turkey, and Venezuela are going to do the same.
It seems like there's some real options right now on the table for Maduro and for Guaido. What are you thinking is going to come down in coming days? Because people are talking about the possibility of violence, all sorts of violence. What are you looking for?
Yeah, I really don't know. It's hard to know who's going to sort of move first, because things were moving so fast yesterday that it was hard to keep up with. And then by last night, they just kind of stagnated. And so I think we could be, a stalemate for the next couple of days. We'll see. We'll see, the big questions are, is the Maduro government going to try to act against Guaido? Is it going to try to arrest him or other people from the opposition? No, I think, is the Maduro government going to try to dislodge people from the U.S. embassy if they don't leave within 72 hours? No. I think is the Trump administration going to do things like try to assign or say Venezuela has right or Guaido has rights over Citgo? I mean, I think all those are big question marks. Probably the most interesting thing that's going on now is that in the region, Mexico did not recognize Guaido, neither did Uruguay. And they put out a joint declaration saying that they are willing to participate in any kind of mediation negotiation efforts. Also, the European Union met for several hours yesterday afternoon to try and figure out what to do. And they came out, they did not recognize Guaido also, or either as president. And they have been saying for weeks, actually for months, that they are interested in a contact group and trying to do high-level contacts with the government and with the opposition. And so there's that going on, and that could lead to a break in what looks like a stalemate at the moment.
Do you take the Trump administration's threat of all things on the table of violence, of military action, is that serious?
Yeah, I always take it serious because, it's something I just remember back in 2002 when George Bush was saying that, we were going to invade Iraq. I was one of those that thought it was funny. I thought it was a joke. It seemed so ridiculous that Saddam Hussein would have anything to do with 9/11. But we saw what happened. And so I think once this ball gets rolling, there's so many interests, there's so many people involved that are interested in this kind of military conflict that it can break out really quickly. And I think especially with a president that's in a situation like Trump, that he has the Russian investigation, he has all kinds of problems, and he has a re-election coming up. And so, it's a time-honored way of sort of boosting your popularity and changing the topic. So I take it seriously. I don't think that people in the administration really want to do this, but I think, once that ball gets rolling, it can happen. And I think there's a consistent underestimation in the United States about what military intervention means. Time and again, we think that it's just go in, get rid of a government and go out and everything's okay. But actually what we've seen in Iraq, Somalia, Libya, is that it actually usually means an extended occupation. And that in itself can lead to huge problems and a lot of violence after an invasion, which itself leads to a lot of death and destruction.
David Smildy is a professor of sociology at Tulane University, and he's a senior fellow with the Washington Office on Latin America. He curates their Venezuelan politics and human rights blog. Thanks a lot for joining us, David Smildy.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we'll learn a few things about pre-colonial Africa. I'm Jerome McDonnell, and you're listening to Worldview on WBEZ.
Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. Most people don't know much about pre-colonial Africa. If that's true about you, a new exhibit at Northwestern's Block Museum of Art is likely to blow your mind. Caravans of Gold opens tomorrow and runs through July 21st. Curator Kathleen Burzak is here. She's Associate Director of Curatorial Affairs at the Block Museum. Great to have you with us.
Hi, Jerome. It's really, really good to be here. Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about medieval Africa. What about it is going to blow our mind when we go to this exhibition?
Well, I think that people are going to find things out about the medieval period that they've never imagined before. A world that was much more interconnected, much more global than is the general perception, I think, in the public, and really seeing what Africa's role in that was. And I think that what we've learned over the years that we've been working on this project is that a lot of people don't put the words medieval and Africa together in their minds, and we're giving them an opportunity to see why, in fact, they should be thinking about those two things at the same time.
Now, I think the crux of it is that the Western Sahara was at the center of global trade at the time. This was not a fluke. This was a deliberate thing that was going on.
This was a really important trading thoroughfares that ran through the Sahara Desert at the time that was being generated because of a strong interest in the gold resources that were found just south of the Sahara Desert in parts of Western Africa. So the rise and falls of empires in this period of time were being carried out basically on this economy of gold. And then along with that, of course, traveled many other materials, but also people and ideas and religious practices. And that's what the exhibition is looking at.
And you can see actual objects from all this period and all these people when
right.
you come to Caravans of Gold.
You can. It's really remarkable. We've been working for over 7 years with partners in Mali, Morocco, and Nigeria to select loans and to tell this bigger story through objects. And so what people are going to see when they come are actual archaeological fragments and works of art from the medieval period that are on loan from lenders in these three African nations. And then they're juxtaposed with other objects from Western museums to open up our imagination about what this period of time looked like.
Give me an example of some of the things people will see.
Mm-hmm. So one of the most wonderful things that somebody's told me about the exhibition is that it brings together things you never would expect to see together. And so, for instance, we have a beautiful gold filigree bead from Egypt or Syria. And this is a form of bead called biconical. It's like two ice cream cones put together at their wide end. And it's all just golden filigree openwork. And it's from the 10th century in Egypt. But then we have that juxtaposed with beads from the 19th and 20th century made in West Africa. And so by looking at those things together, we see how a form and some and techniques were circulating in the medieval period and then have had this long legacy into the present day. Another really exciting example is that we have some of the greatest works of sculpture from the medieval period from the country of the present-day country of Nigeria. And one of these iconic works is known as the Tada Seated Man. So this is an almost life-size figure of a ruler sitting in a very naturalistic pose. And it's made of almost pure copper. And we believe that that copper came from the Alpine region of France and came down, that raw copper came down through Saharan routes all the way into the forest region of Nigeria, where it was used for making cast copper sculpture, among other things. So we have then juxtaposed that with an ivory figure because what was on the other side of that exchange was ivory moving northward across Saharan routes into places like North Africa and Sicily and Italy and France, where it was being used to make the Gothic sculpture that many of us are very familiar with. So we have loans of some remarkable ivory figures of the Virgin and Child, boxes, ivory panels. And we ask the question that it seems so obvious, but that we rarely ask, which is, where did that ivory come from?
It is the mind-blowing part of this, to think of all these different kinds of goods going back and forth. And
right.
There are people who are doing the trading, and I know you create and give us some people to think about. Mm-hmm. Mansa Musa. Who is Mansa Musa?
So Mansa Musa is was a hugely important person in this period of time. He was the king of the Empire of Mali. So in this region known as the Western Sudan in West Africa, there was, just like many other places in this world, empires rising and falling through an 8 or 9 century period of time. The Empire of Mali in the 13th and 14th centuries was really controlling this access to the gold resources. And Mansa Musa, as the Empire of Mali, as the emperor of the Empire of Mali, is perhaps thought to be the richest man ever in the history of the world. He became a Muslim, and he made a pilgrimage to Mecca. And this pilgrimage is well documented in Arabic sources of the period. And some of these descriptions include descriptions of things he was given or things that he purchased, as well as the actions he took, how much gold he distributed so that it affected the economies and the sort of price of gold at the time dropped because of the way he was saturating the market.
He was the Saudi Arabia of gold.
He was the Bezos or the Bill Gates of gold.
Somebody.
This description includes types of things he was given: silk and gold thread textiles, a Damascene sword. And what we've done is we've taken that description and we've brought together objects of the period that are like the ones he must have encountered to, again, open up our imagination about what this time looked like.
It's really interesting to go back, and I imagine most people you meet don't really know much about this period, and you can fill them in.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really important thing for us to do, to think about the long past and to fill in, you know, history is a living thing and our understanding of it changes all the time. And when we have an opportunity to correct a misperception or to bring a story like this, which is well known in historical circles, but isn't perhaps as much in the mainstream of our idea of a past. We think that that's really critical work.
I'm talking with curator Kathleen Berzac, and we're discussing Caravans of Gold. It opens tomorrow and runs through July 21st at Northwestern's Black Museum of Art. So what do we... There are interesting parallels to today, actually. I mean, you mentioned design parallels, but there are all sorts of things about immigration and trade and exploitation that we can all learn from and apply to today.
Absolutely. So one of the things that we've been doing is developing working with partners to create curriculum for teachers to have access to. We think it's hugely important for people today to be thinking about the history of Africa before the Atlantic slave trade, before colonialism, and that school kids should really have that full picture in their heads. It can have an impact on our interactions with colleagues, our global colleagues today. So we think that that's important. And of course, we hear stories that are in the news all the time about people moving across the Sahara Desert as migrants today or across the Mediterranean. And it's often posed with a very kind of short view idea of boundaries and of borders. And this story makes us realize that there has been movements across the century, across the Sahara Desert for centuries, even millennia. And in fact, one of the chapters in the companion publication to the book addresses how movements across the Sahara today are still following these same routes and have many different kinds of precedents.
Now, you've got some really interesting things going on this weekend. The exhibit opens tomorrow at the Black Museum of Art. And then this weekend, you've got a couple of big things going on. What's going
on? Yeah. So we have been working, as I said, with partners in Mali, Morocco, and Nigeria. And we have a number of visitors from those countries here, the directors of institutions, and who are going to be participating in the opening. And then we have a program on Saturday that will begin at 2 p.m. The museum opens at 10. It's free and open to the public. Anybody can come and participate in seeing the exhibition. There's going to be some live music by a kora player. And then at 2 o'clock, we're going to have a program where I'll be speaking, and the director of the National Museum of African Art, Gus Casely Hayford, who is a specialist on the history of the city of Timbuktu and its visual culture, he'll be speaking. The novelist and cultural critic, Chris Abani, who is a faculty member at Northwestern, will be speaking, and then we'll be having a conversation together about some of the key notions in the exhibition, the history, but also the idea of the archaeological imagination and the importance of fragments in telling this story.
And that conversation, once again, is at 2 o'clock at the Pick Stagger Concert Hall. So you are in a great big auditorium.
We have lots of space. Please come down.
That would be an amazing thing to have and see. That's a great conversation. And people, the exhibit itself, you mentioned your partners, the Smithsonian, and it's going to travel to the Aga Khan Museum in Toronto.
It is.
It's going to be a big deal. Your 8 years of work on the exhibit have paid off.
They have. You know, it's super exciting. As a campus museum, a university museum, we're really dedicated to pushing the envelope on the stories we tell in museums and using the art museum as a place for people to come into touch with history and the way that art history can animate the past for us. And it's thrilling when important colleagues like the Aga Khan Museum in Toronto and the National Museum of African Art on the Mall in Washington, D.C., want to take the exhibition that we've created and present them to their publics.
And I imagine your partners in Morocco and Mali and Nigeria are thrilled to see this this exchange happen.
It's been just an unbelievably rewarding experience. In the past eight years, I've made 9 trips to Mali, Morocco, and Nigeria. I've hosted the Black Museum, and I have hosted 4 scholars meetings. And there's a huge number of people across disciplines and across areas of expertise who've been really investing in this project, and it's just wonderful to see it coming together like this.
And it's a great opportunity for people in this area to go to the Black Museum, and they don't have to go to the Smithsonian and see it.
That's
they can
right.
go to the Black Museum.
Here. That's right. I mean, see it here first, you know, and again, the Black is free and open to the public, so it's a wonderful opportunity.
And you only got a little bit. We did a story earlier this week about the exhibition having some problems with the government shutdown.
Yeah, we did. We had we have 23 loans from the National Museum of African Art in the exhibition. And of course, when the government shut down, many of our colleagues there have been furloughed. And it was touch and go for a while about whether or not those loans would be able to be packed and transported here. We actually ended up canceling the first truck that had been booked to ship the loans. We missed that. But they were able to get some special permission for employees in a certain with certain funding to go in and pack the objects and bring them to us. And we were able to get them installed in time for the opening. So we're really grateful for that.
Well, congratulations on the exhibit. I can't wait to get up there and see it. Yeah, the Northwestern Black Museum of Art and their Caravan of Gold exhibit opens tomorrow and runs through July 21st. And once again, there is an open house on Saturday from 10:30 to 1, and then at 2 o'clock, a panel discussion at the Pick Stagger Concert Hall. It's been great meeting you, and thanks for the effort. Kathleen Burzak is the curator of the Caravans of Gold exhibit. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Jerome, thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Coming up after the break, we'll talk about a film series on Cuba. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ.
Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at WBEZ.org/events.
This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. There's a chance to see Cuban films and talk about them this year at a Cuban Vision film series. This unique series starts tonight with films on racial inequity and class in a changing Cuba. It's at the Athenaeum Theater here in Chicago, and with me is Alexandra Halkin. She's a documentary filmmaker and director of the Americas Media Initiative, and she programmed the Cuban Vision film series. Thanks for joining us, Alexandra. We're old pals from your work with the Chiapas Media Project years ago, and we had you in the Global Activism series. And I've seen some of your Cuban films that you've been flirting with over the years. What to explain your interest in Cuban film and filmmaking and how you came to this film series?
Thanks, Jerome, for having us today. It's a pleasure to be here again. I actually started working in Cuba in 1991 when the special period was very strong. That was after the Soviet Union fell and had a very detrimental effect in Cuba. And I had been filming in Cuba at that time. And then I worked in Mexico for a number of years and developed an educational distribution network with the films from the Zapatistas. And so I started going back to Cuba in 2009, and I was invited to a film festival, and I saw a number of independently produced Cuban films that had no international distribution. And I thought, well, why don't I try and get these films distributed outside of Cuba? And that's when I decided to form the America's Media Initiative that focuses on work with independent Cuban filmmakers that live in Cuba.
Now you figured, why not just have a film series? Why not just go right out there and you're going to every other month now show Cuban films and have people talk about them?
Yeah, I've done a number of different programs. I've curated at Documentary Fortnight at the Museum of Modern Art. I've done film festivals, but stuff like that is usually pretty short, and it's just a couple days. And I really thought it would be a great opportunity to do an actual year-long film series with films that are rarely, if ever, seen in Cuba, and use the films as a starting-off point to discuss themes that are universal between the United States and Cuba that affect the citizens both in Cuba and in the United States.
Explain what you mean when you say the films are not seen so much in Cuba. What kind of films are we talking about here?
Well, the films are not seen so much in the United States. Cuban films are seen in Cuba.
Right.
They may not be on Cuban television and they may not be in Cuban film festivals, but people are really good at passing films around on a flash drive, or there's this thing called the paquete, which is 1 terabyte of films and internet websites and all different kinds of stuff that is circulated every week in Cuba. And a lot of Cuban filmmakers who want the Cuban population to see their films will put their films in the paquete.
Well, let's talk about what you're doing tonight at the Athenaeum Theater, and you've brought your guests who are going to take part in the conversation with you. And the theme tonight is racial inequity and class in a changing Cuba. And with us is Monica Rivero. She's a Cuban journalist and is the editorial director of On Cuba News. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having us. Well, tonight we are going to see Canción de Barrio, which is a documentary I worked in. It was filmed from 2012 to 2014 or so. And it's about a tour of a famous Cuban trovador, Silvio Rodriguez. And it was tempting, the fact of joining him through the tour. But we wanted to answer the question, why is Silvio Rodriguez interested in going to these communities? Because the tour wants to make focus on communities and neighborhoods that are mostly outside of the cultural centers of the city. You know, it's like the more poor neighborhoods, mostly in Havana, but also outside Havana. And we wanted to answer, why is a very famous artist that have raised the highest scenarios in the world wanted to come to these communities? Why?
What's the answer? I'm dying to know.
I guess you have to see the documentary.
He cares about class. He's interested in inequality.
Yeah, we were always before the concert, because we went to the communities about 4 or 5 hours before the concert took place and talked to the people in the places. We showed what are their dreams, what are their frustrations, how do they live. We took a time for observe their homes, the way they lived, in a word, right? So that's the fact, and that's why you can try to answer that question through seeing how these people live, how is their day life.
Also with us is Odette Casamayor Cisneros. She's an associate professor of Latin American and Caribbean cultures at the University of Connecticut, and Afro-Cuban people, there's a kind of the government and has a unique approach to them. How do you talk about that in a film series? What is going on in the film series about the Afro-Cuban community?
Well, as you will see probably in the documentary, many of the interviews and many of the people living in those places, of the majority of the neighbors that were interviewed, were or are Afro-Cubans. And it shows that the majority of people living in bad conditions in Cuba are black Cubans. It's not something new. It's something that is happening since the, we will say, since the birth of the nation. What's going on is that right now, with the critical economic and political and social conditions in Cuba, all those racial inequalities, not only racial inequalities, but it's probably the most visible inequality that we can address in the, and we can see in the movie, those inequalities are more important right now, and it's from history. The roots of the of this are of course are in slavery, and the main question would be how is it possible that socialist system that has been in place and that implemented equality in measures trying to implement some equality in Cuba. How is possible that after more than 50 years, we still have racial inequalities, clear racial inequalities in Cuba? And it's something that, unfortunately, we cannot address in only one documentary, in only one discussion. But at least the documentary is showing it. And it will be clear for the viewers that there something has to be done in Cuba in order to avoid the context or to stop this those inequalities.
The title of tonight's discussion is Racial Inequity and Class in a Changing Cuba. Is Cuba really changing that much? Is there that much change in the economic system that is going to start addressing inequality? Is it going to you're saying no already with your head.
Well, from my point of view, yes, there is a lot of changes in Cuba right now. This has been happening since 20 years now, let's say. In 2006, for instance, it was possible to for Cubans to have private property, which was something unthinkable before, but it's something that is actually increasing inequalities, because what we are experiencing right now in Cuba is the development of a wealthy class, really wealthy class, and then in the other side, the majority of Cubans whose living conditions are always worsening. And I would say, yes, there is a lot of changes, a lot of transformations in Cuba, but unfortunately not for the best.
Alexander, do you want to weigh in on this?
I prefer to have Cubans speak about what's going on in Cuba, because I think they're the ones that really know, because they're from Cuba. I'll just speak about why I wanted to show this film. I think this film is really unique. It's very rare for documentaries to show this kind of situation, especially in a feature documentary, and a feature documentary that was produced with somebody like Silvio Rodriguez, who lives in Cuba, who's a renowned Cuban musician. The fact that he made the decision to produce this documentary and the book that Monica and Alejandro worked on, I think says something about his concern about what is going on in Cuba.
Monica, do you want to say something there?
Yes, I agree with Alex and Odette. And I just, indeed, the fact that the tour had begun in that date was because it was a political discourse of opening of economic flexibilization. And then it was a way of saying, hold on a sec, there's a big Cuban community that's out of this train of progress that it was supposed to be
going.
Yeah. It's like we don't get to this even if it's small opening of the economy, of the possibility of have private property in the same conditions. So it was the right moment to look at those who cannot join that move.
Now, this is just the opening volley of the film series, and explain what's going to happen. It's going to happen every other month, and you're going to take up a different topic every other month.
Yes. The next film and discussion is going to be March 1st, and it's about LGBTQ rights and gay marriage in Cuba. We're going to be showing a number of short films by Afro-Cuban queer filmmaker Damian Sainz, and he's going to be present along with Norge Espinosa, who's also an LGBTQ activist and playwright.
Amazing.
And author. So that's the next series. And then in May, I don't remember the exact date, but you could check online on the Athenaeum site or on the AMI site, will be Economics 101, which is a film called The Unique Story of Unlucky Juan, which is kind of a hybrid documentary, which looks kind of breaks down the situation with the Cuban economy. And hopefully we're going to have the director there along with a Cuban blogger, Harold Cardenas.
And it sounds amazing. There's going to be Emerging Women Filmmakers in July, Revolutionary Aspirations, Where Are We Now in October, and The Personal is Political in November. So that's an amazing thing you're doing there.
Well, I
hope people check it out. It's at the Athenaeum Theater, and you can see tonight a film on racial inequality and class in a changing Cuba, and take part in the discussion afterwards with our guests, Monica Rivera, Cuban journalist, director of On Cuban News, and Odette Casamayor Cisneros, associate professor in Latin American and Caribbean cultures at the University of Connecticut. Thank you both for joining us. Enjoy the film and the discussion tonight. And it's been great seeing you again, Alexandra Halkin, documentary filmmaker and director of the Americas Media Initiative. And for more information, people go to the American Media's Initiative website or the Athenaeum Theater.
Yep.
Thanks a
Thank
lot
you
for
so
joining
much,
us.
Jerome.
I'm Jerome McDonnell. You've been listening to Worldview on WBEZ.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.